The Right to Question is supported in part by the Paul Allen Family Foundation, by Humanities Montana, and by listeners like you.
Why did David James Duncan call you a Wendell Berry-style mad farmer?
I think there are a few things going on there. First is his own generosity and kindness to even put me in the same sentence with Wendell Berry. And then the other things I think that are going on there are a shared subject matter. Wendell Berry wrote a lot about farming. And the last piece that I think is telling here is the emotion that's in some of the Mad Farmer poems. And I hope that some of those are in my poems. Some of it's anger or rejoicing or sadness. It runs the whole spectrum. But those Mad Farmer poems, there's a lot of passion in there. And that's really what drives me to write anything down. If I didn't feel passionate about it, I wouldn't write it down. When I'm writing these things, I imagine myself reading them out loud and sharing them. And passion is what carries the day with any storytelling. And I hope that's what David James Duncan was referring to, and also him being kind and generous too.
Welcome to The Right Question, a program that features authors from the Western U.S. I'm Cherie Newman, talking with poet and farmer Josh Slotnick about his collection of poetry titled Home Farm. In the introduction to this collection, you write about monks creating intimate sand mandalas, saying that what they do reminds you of farming. What's the comparison there?
So the comparison there is about art and artifice and creation and permanence, or in this case, a lack of permanence. So with the sand mandalas, these guys make these beautiful, intricate forms, bright colors, tremendous amounts of labor poured into it. And then the pouring keeps on going. At the end, they pour it all into the water. The beauty there is in the process, not the finished product. They're not attached. And with vegetable farming, over the course of the season, you make this beautiful thing, this field, with all these bright colors and changes in topography. And it's really gorgeous on every sensory level. And at the end, you mow it all down and till it in, and it's flat and brown once again. It can't be too attached. And that's how I see those things as being similar. And they're both about process more than about finished product.
For you, farmer is really not a job title. It's a lifestyle that you and your family live. How did you get there? How did you go from college student to farmer?
It was a bit circuitous, but right after college, I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Thailand. And I was surrounded by young men. Those are the people that I was interacting with in the little town I was living in, who could grow their own food and fix their own machines and build their own houses and do what needed to be done. And I felt at the time that, man, I had got this education, but I'm not a very useful person. And I wanted to remake myself into being a useful person. And I really enjoyed hard work and being outside, and I love food. And so it all just sort of unfolded for me that this was the path I should follow. And I left the Peace Corps and went and worked on a farm at UC Santa Cruz, a student farm, and I did a six-month apprenticeship. It's where I met my wife. And after experiencing that, there was no turning back.
What kind of a background did you come from? What was your childhood experience?
Suburban, mainstream America. I mean, nothing that you would link up to what I'm doing right now in any way.
Your poem titled Rules to Self gives readers just a small glimpse of what it takes each day to be a farmer, to live this lifestyle. And I'm wondering if you'll read that for us.
Sure, yeah. So this is Rules to Self. And this poem begins with a Wendell Berry quote. I'll read the quote first. It is presumptuous and irresponsible to pray for other people. Here's the poem. Stare down a spot on the far fence and don't let go. You'll drive straight enough. With the zeal of a believer, grease every zerk on every piece of spinning steel. Call your son, even if he doesn't have much to say. Put new transplants under the greenhouse tables, in the shade, till they bounce back. Keep the tractors under roof. Notice the changing patterns of snow in the hills, the volatile skies, the dog's pride in you, this place, all that is hers to care for. If you think you need a hammer, think again. For most things, there's a better way. jump at the windows of soil dry enough for field work. Any day rain could fall, not stopping long enough for the soil to dry before raining again. Change fluids and filters early before you get too busy and deep damage begins to grow. Put every tool and part you might need in a bucket. Wrenches, confidence, sockets, stillness, wire cutters, drill, pry bar, doubt. Carry all to the repair job at hand. Walking back and forth kills the day. Buy extra parts. If this one doesn't break, another one will. Don't let yourself get too thirsty. Listen to the roaring engine, the implement behind, the clouds stacking to the southwest, your squawking back, the phone messages, your best guesses. Be soft on the throttle. Take only the RPMs you need. Backhaul. Remind your daughters of their breath-stopping beauty. Why keep that to yourself? Check the weather often. Do what's right for the weather today, tomorrow. Know that you contrive your plan for the week. But weather is real. Math is real. Squeeze a handful of soil, drop it from your hip. If it breaks into pieces, you're good to till. If it hits the earth and remains balled up, it's too wet. Bursts into dust, too dry. Put yourself last. Know that you can deal. Hug your wife. You will feel better. Understand you will never work as hard or measure up. Get past that. Let diesels warm before using them hard. Never run them out of fuel. Trust. Spend your mental energy on what the season, the conditions, your family call for. Everything will work out or not. Question your compulsions. So, the summer that I was 18, I did some work for a couple and they had a young baby out in the country. This was outside of Grand Forks, North Dakota. And they had a big garden and kind of a homestead. He was a law student. Had a long ponytail. They had sheep, and they were shearing the sheep, and she spun. And I'd never encountered anything like this, and this just sounds like hippies, but that's not what it was that I encountered. What I found when I got there were these people who absolutely loved each other and loved where they lived and their little life, and I hadn't ever seen that. I had very traditional suburban, broken home, TV, regular stuff, wonderful parents, but at the time, they couldn't really be that way. And I felt on some visceral level that those folks I was doing this landscaping type work for, that they had just tapped into something. I didn't know what it was. I couldn't have put it into words, but I wanted nothing more than to go back there. And she paid me with a pie and made me lunch. And I just wanted to be there. And I think that stuck with me too when I saw this happening in Thailand, that it wasn't just the work and being useful, that I had this sense that through that work, I could tap into what those people had tapped into, which was really love.
And that comes through in this collection of poems in many, many places. That powerful sense of family and your relationship with your wife. And it's not all lovey-dovey.
No.
I'm going to ask you to read a poem later that kind of addresses the tense times. But back to this one you just read. Mm-hmm. The last line, question your compulsions.
Yeah.
What does that mean to you?
Well, everything that I had just said before that, these are kind of compulsions. These are this rules to self, telling myself, in moments of doubt, what am I supposed to be doing? And I would think, well, what would I say to someone else who was doing this, who was on this tractor at this point or facing this decision? And that's what this is. Is my response to my own questions. But these are kind of compulsions. And the question, your compulsions, is a reminder not to get too certain in what I think is right and wrong.
And especially with farming, because you are so locked into what's happening with the weather. You can make all the lists you want, but
it doesn't matter. You have a goal for the week, but it can all get thrown for a loop. And really being attentive to that, and well, it's raining, so I'm going to do this job inside today. I'm not going to force it and go outside and make a big mess.
Yeah. Most of us non-farmers live with this illusion that we can control what's happening in our lives, in our careers.
For sure. Yeah.
But you face the reality every single day that you have no control because the weather is going to dictate what is happening.
Yeah. It's our job to respond appropriately.
So are you obsessed with the weather forecast?
You know, in the spring and in the fall, but in midsummer here, we usually get a kind of a steady, it's blue sky and hot. And sometimes it gets too hot, and then I get a little obsessed with it. But in spring and fall, I check all the time.
Well, farming is all about the production of food, and it's food for other people to eat mm-hmm. and food for yourself to eat. So part of the job involves animals, and you've written several poems about that in the book. Mm-hmm. And in fact, you dedicate 4 poems in this book to pigs. And I'd like you to read the one titled Egyptian Pigs. But before you do that, sure. Tell us about your experience with pigs in Montana, the synopsis of what's happening in the first 3 poems about pigs.
Wow. So I made some mistakes with some pigs up at the Pease Farm.
And say what the Pease Farm is.
So I live on a farm that my wife runs, but I'm there weekends and evenings and in the thick of it 7 days a week for 6 months. But during weekday hours, I go work at the Pease Farm. The Pease Farm is a partnership between the university, between the Environmental Studies Program and the nonprofit Garden City Harvest. We grow food for the food bank, and it's a living classroom for environmental studies students and for elementary school kids and some high school kids. It's really a community-based farm. And we still have pigs there. And 1 year we had pigs there, and we dispatched the pigs right there, which is what we had been doing. And it's really a powerful and kind of horrible thing to see. And it was quite in public, and it really bothered some folks. And I kind of came face to face with that maybe this had been a good decision for the life of the pigs, that this was a good way for them to end their lives as opposed to being hauled away in a truck. But it was much too much to be in public. And it wasn't like in the middle of the day with a big crowd around, but it was visible. And it really angered a lot of people, and I had to deal with that.
And you got phone calls.
Oh, my. There were people who were really mad about it. They had good points, and they needed to be listened to, and I learned a whole lot through the experience, and we don't do that anymore. But it really gave rise to a lot of emotion, other people's and my own. And then being interested in this, I started seeing it in other places. So that's where the Egyptian pigs poem came from. When this was all happening and somebody said, you should see this YouTube video. Look what's going on in Cairo. This is all around H1N1. And there it was again, pigs and death and people screaming and yelling. And it was on a more intense level than it happened here, but I felt a kinship to it. So I wrote it down.
You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman, talking with poet and farmer Josh Slotnick about his latest collection of poetry, Home Farm. If you tuned in late, you can hear what you missed at mtpr.org/twq. Right after a short break, Josh will read his poem, Egyptian Pigs, and we'll talk more about the value of community farms. Stay tuned. People are upset by the pigs being killed, and you're doing it in the most humane way that you think is possible at the time. And yet they will go to the grocery store and buy their cellophane-wrapped bacon. There's a huge disconnect there, I think.
Yeah, and I think even with people who fully get what's happening, they understand it. Seeing death and killing is awful. It's just awful. They were responding viscerally just to that. It's awful. And because it's awful, we put it away societally. We have deeply concentrated, intensely concentrated the livestock industry, whether it's cattle, beef, chickens or pigs. So a very small amount of firms do most all the work, and they do this work in faraway rural places, mostly with immigrant labor, low skill, low wage, low politically empowered labor that doesn't last very long. And so for people who are just one social rung above that, socioeconomic rung above that, we don't have to look at it. And what's happening in these industrial farms is much more grisly than what happened with us, but we don't see it. If we did, if that was right in people's faces, we wouldn't allow it, I don't believe. No person of conscience would allow it. But it's not in our day-to-day life, and our lives are so full and so busy, none of us can barely get done what we're supposed to do, more or less worry about how pigs are treated in northern Colorado. So I understand why it goes on. But I think this very sense of we're going to put away what is awful to look at is kind of a prerequisite for more awfulness. If we were seeing it, we wouldn't allow it.
Yes, and we wouldn't be buying meat from certain sources.
Absolutely, yeah. So I don't condemn any of the people that were angry, and it was a really horrible thing that all went down. I understand it, and I think a lot of the people involved understand the disconnect. And anybody who's ever seen a living thing die, it's especially a violent death, it's pretty awful.
And so then came the Egyptian pigs.
Yeah, so I'll read this one. Egyptian pigs. The Coptic Christians of Cairo drive donkey carts, push wheelbarrows, pull janky trailers behind ancient Japanese scooters, women mostly, babies swaddled across their backs like bike messenger bags, faces grimy, hands hard as horn. They make garbage go away for 9 million other people. In rubble-strewn courtyards, they sort cardboard, glass, paper, plastic by number, steel, aluminum, copper. They burn the wood, but anything that used to be alive, they feed to pigs. H1N1 swine flu grips the globe. Mexico shuts down. Schools close in San Diego, but Cairo erupts. Walls of riot police move in lockstep, firing tear gas into the crowd. A ragged mob of Coptics huck stones, scream blistering epithets. Some of the garbage people charge, take the pepper spray, the billy clubs. Helmeted cops in mirrored face shields blast a cloud of rubber bullets, making cover. A phalanx of men and women in lab coats and gas masks sprints from a crack in the law enforcement monolith. Syringes hang in their hands like daggers. Rocks fly. Pigs scream. The veterinarians give chase.
That image is really something to end the book with, I'll tell you. And I guess it's the difference between our country and other countries in that we sanitize everything. We put it way over here so we don't have to see it out in the streets.
Yeah, we've put a really high value on not just physical security, which I would never be arguing against that, but kind of an emotional security too. And I think what this has done is sort of a tautology, minimizes physical and emotional risk. And I do believe a sense of risk is required for an understanding of personal growth. And I think this causes people, especially young people, to sort of behaviorally squeeze out sideways and search for risk and search for the edge of things in ways that are a little bit more dangerous than we would like. Because in regular life, everything is polished up clean and shiny and sanitary and made safe as can be. And again, I'm not advocating for riskiness in fourth grade, but there's a consequence of having such a safe and clean world.
Mm-hmm. So all a kid has to do if they want to get some risk in their lives is go do some farming.
Do a little farming. Be involved in something that's unpredictable.
Right.
And that can be any types of outdoor recreation, all kinds of things where you just don't. And you can see with the appeal of sports in this way. We don't know how it's going to unfold. It's organic, right? As opposed to most things, we pretty much know what's going to happen next. We've made sure we do so that everyone will be safe.
Mm-hmm. You also write about turkeys. And I really enjoyed in this book the way that you weave in your personal experiences, your emotions, what's happening with other people in your life into your experiences as a farmer. And so I'd like you to read Giving Thanks a few years later.
Yeah. Yeah, this nonfiction poetry. So this describes the events of one day right around Thanksgiving, a handful of years ago. It's called Giving Thanks a Few Years Later. The sliding barn door slams against the far wall. Winter light pours in like water through floodgates. Dust floats in trapped sun. I reach up and grab the feet of one more stunned and screaming blue-green-brown Narragansett turkey roosting in the rafters. Quick! He's upside down, wings spread out, heavy body bouncing against the right hip of my spattered coveralls. 100 turkeys, 8 friends, 3 days before Thanksgiving. So many conversations with my buddy about this place, his place, rented but for sale. A low-slung cabin, a handful of shack-like structures, and 80 acres of good ground lying in the soft belly of the great sweep of this valley, spread wide from the Sharktooth Mission Mountains soaring platinum against a winter gray sky to the glacial green Flathead River curved like a snake sunning itself along burlap hills to the west. Maybe with partners they could pull it off. If interest rates drop, if he works in town a few days a week, sleeps in his office, there's an old friend with some cash could help, just wants a place to put up a cabin. But the owner needs to know she bought a bigger piece up the road. He sees playing children, modern tractors, buildings shorn up, plumbed, straight, painted. His girlfriend, not yet 27, speaks of her family so far away. I stuff the shining, upside-down Tom into a cone, screwed to a wide plank of fencing, in a line of 3 bird-filled cones. Their heads poke out, skinny necks straining to squawk. I pull across and down with a long blade, thin as straw. Blood runs in rivulets across the broad board onto frozen mud. The turkeys bounce along through this process, through the day, from barn to killing cone to plucker to gutting table to a shiny stock tank, where bagged turkeys bob with chunks of ice in glacial meltwater. Bagged, the turkeys look just like turkey, but not at all like birds. We stop work only for a full-on farm lunch in the hissing wood stove cabin, the whole year on a table. Venison chili, roasted winter squash, pickled veggies spicy and sour, pumpkin pie, soda bread, scalding hot black coffee. Looking back, my buddy, the turkeys in the barn, the group working wordlessly together, all new. Who buys big spreads? Which animals survive us? And when a shining time in all its gutty, futile glory comes and goes.
You obviously experience farming as much more than a job. As I said before, it's a whole lifestyle for you. How does this way of living benefit your family and the community that you live in?
Wow. It benefits our family, I think, in that for our children, what their parents do is not a mystery. I remember as a kid, my parents would disappear and come back at the end of the day, and I would have a label to put on what they did, but it didn't mean anything, especially for my wife, who's there all the time. They know exactly what she's doing, and there's a closeness there that comes from that. And they can contribute and be part of it and understand the cycles of all of it. They're in it in a way that I think of my own childhood. I wasn't in my parents' life and my parents weren't in my life, where we are in it together. And where we live isn't our house, but it's this whole property. And the people that come and live with us in the summertime as well, it's all part of the swirl. And I think for my kids, it's given them a really rich upbringing and a sense of attachment to a place that they otherwise wouldn't have. And an understanding of their parents as people and an understanding of their parents as parents that's much more informed than the typical pattern. What does this lifestyle do for a community? I don't know. You know, I think that participating in things like farmers market has this obvious community benefit. People want to eat this type of food and they come together around it. So the fact that this is available has sparked community, not just with my family, but there's dozens of families around the valley that do this type of work. But the fact that we live in this way, I think maybe it does something that people can see it across the fence and kind of wonder about it a little bit. Not that it's necessarily better or worse, but just that it's different.
Yeah.
In the summertime, I cook for our crew and I will ask my daughters to run out and get, you know, go grab a bunch of collards and pull some beets out, and they'll go and do it. They know where it is and that's where food comes from. And all of them in their own way have become serious food snobs. Not that they're demanding organic or demanding, you know, aioli or something, but They just know what fresh food is and know what it takes. And when they eat the kind that doesn't taste like that and look like that, they're not interested so much.
There are also some programs that happen through the Pease Farm, yeah. I think, if I'm remembering correctly, that have to do with teens that are at risk.
Yeah. Yeah, we have at the Pease Farm, we have a group of between 5 and 8 teenagers, some of which we get through drug court, some come to us just through the regular school system, some through the organization Youth Homes, and they work on the Pease Farm shoulder to shoulder with university kids. They're paid a stipend, and they mix in with that group. They help us grow 10 acres of food. They're right in the thick of it. And the benefits of seeing tangible results from your work and from being part of a community are felt by the teenagers as much as they're felt by the university students. And I think the two groups actually enrich each other's experience. We also get some years up to 4,000 school kids visiting the farm on field trips and for camps. So it's a very alive and public place.
I think I remember one teenager who was a part of the farm at one point who her whole life turned around.
Oh, I mean,
do drugs anymore.
And yeah, we've had a bunch of that actually. And it isn't because these things are preached there. It's because for a lot of people, being part of that community is the first time they've ever been part of something so inclusive and so healthy and vibrant and reinforcing of positive values. And it lifts people up when they see that if not for them, all these good things would not have happened, that they were essential to making this beautiful place really just kind of sing. And so they feel really proud. And you mix that with how they feel when they realize they're part of this group that's welcoming and doesn't care if they have purple hair or a nose ring or whatever. They're just there. And they're there to help. And their work is respected. And then we eat together. And you put all this together. And it's kind of magical.
Hmm. Well, last question.
Sure.
This is all really hard work. What propels you out of bed and out into the day, every day, day after day after day?
Often what propels me is a sense of obligation, which isn't as heartfelt an answer, but it's an obligation to all that life. So we've planted these crops, we have to care for them. We've brought these children into the world, we have to care for them. It's obligation and responsibility. And all that gives back to you.
Even though both growing seasons are really short.
I know. Now my kids are all growing up and leaving one by one, and one's already gone. Oh, I can definitely see that. And it really calls to question, like, well, what do we do next? Do we do this just for ourselves? Maybe that's enough. Maybe not. I don't know. I think farming, and this is a Wendell Berryism, it's the creation of a place, and the place is where you want your children to live. Now, when they don't need that anymore, you have to wonder why you're doing it. It has to transfer over a bit for yourself and for your community.
Oh, maybe you can find it in a poem.
Yeah, we'll see.
Josh Slotnick lives in Missoula, Montana, where he is director of the Pease Farm and a University of Montana professor. Look for more information about him, as well as links to our podcast and Facebook page at mtpr.org/twq. I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you a pile of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, with help from Barbara Thoreau and Kim Anderson. Michael Marsalek, executive producer. Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer. Music for this program was written and performed by John Floridis. The Right Question has a Facebook page, a blog, and a podcast. You'll find links to all that at mtpr.org/twq. Thanks for listening and for supporting this program.